Aid Station's been really looking after a lot of Aussie athletes, which is great. And we're stoked to have them on for our show as well as a show sponsor. So thanks to Aid Station. They're the leading online store for endurance sports nutrition in Australia and New Zealand. Whether you're a pro or training for your first event, they've got everything you need to fuel your performance. Over 1,000 products from 80 top brands, including gels, hydration, energy gear. You'll find it all in one place. Download the Aid Station app now or visit aidstation.com.au. Welcome back, Triathlon Therapy. We are in Taupo for the Ironman 70.3 World Championships. And I've reached out to Bevan McKinnon, who's a New Zealand-based coach who I've known for a long time and actually listened to his podcast, especially as I was up and coming for many years, Fitter Radio. And I reached out to him a long time to come on and have a chat with me. And being in Taupo, where he lives, it made perfect sense to actually do it in person. So Bevan's been a really great podcaster, where a lot of people have obviously gained a ton of information from your podcast. A good athlete himself, and also just a really fantastic coach, a great history of very successful coaching experiences with some really world-class athletes, including Braden Curry, Hannah Berry, and now working really closely with Jack Moody, who's really on the rise. Bev, welcome.
Thank you, mate. Thank you. At a World Champs, where I will remind you, in your glory days, 2016, I was able to secure the age group win.
Did you?
You actually messaged me after the race, after you'd won.
Yeah.
And said to me, because you didn't realise until I went up on stage, you went, oh shit, I didn't realise you've won your age group. So that's the kind of person you are, really.
Mate, when you're winning races, the only person in your world is you.
And then if you do win, you're happy to talk to everyone else afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my best, but last night I'm staying with one of our coaches, Paddy Main.
Yeah.
And his granddad's got a place here, and it's a beautiful old house, and he's 94 years old, but it's like a full gin distillery. And so I turn up for dinner, and he's telling me, you know, it looks so sophisticated, all this distillery equipment, and I'm like, he offers me a gin, and I'm like, well, I can't say no. Wasn't planning on drinking until maybe after the race. And then he gives me this gin, and it's like, just blows my socks off. And so I ask him, oh, so what's the process around your like gin making? He goes, oh, well, I don't know if you'd really call it gin. It's basically just 100% alcohol. I had to sneak off and put like half down the sink.
Yeah. You don't mind a drink every now and again, mate, but starting off on gin, no mixer.
Oh, I then had to get, initially when he gave it to me, I then got some tonic, and I was like, I can't. He looked at me like I was just completely weak.
Did you feel it?
I was like, yeah, that's enough for me. I was going to be real fresh for this podcast, and then...
Okay, no, so welcome to Taupo then, mate.
Thank you. I've got to learn to say that properly too.
The only reason I'm good, and I now live coming up 4 years, but with our work with Ironman over the years and our podcast, I kept getting it wrong way back in the day. And they said, you need to change.
Yeah.
And so I need to change, but my God, I butchered it for 6 months. Taupo, and I only get it now, but I have to consciously say it to myself almost in advance of saying it every single time. But yeah.
It's a hard one.
Yeah.
I guess before we get into it, I had a bit of a theme for this podcast, but chatting to you about the 70.3 World Champs, I guess, can you give us your take on the likely scenario of how you see it playing out, I guess, starting with the women?
Yeah.
And then going through to the men?
Yeah. We debated this morning, and there's runners in the field for sure. The likes of Julie Duron, Ash Gentle. There are bikers in the field. There's swimmers in the field. But knowing the bike course, I think that how close the women got to maybe catching Taylor Nib in Dubai at the last T100 is not going to happen. I suspect the nature of this course in the first 30Ks is she won't... In Dubai, she didn't get to the front till 15Ks in and then made inroads into the field. I suspect that she's going to get to the front very early, and I would not be surprised at all if she doesn't get off the bike with a 6 to 7 minute lead on the next woman. And she's, I always hate it when people say that she's a weak runner. I don't think she's a weak runner at all. There's some excellent runners who are better than her.
Mm.
But when you put the total combination of swim, bike, run together, her run will finish off a race seeing her on the podium every single time. So I just feel that it's a race for second and third between the runners, who are decent swimmers and bikers as well.
Yeah. And I guess on to the men's race. It's going to be... There's some exciting new prospects in the mix, especially with Hayden Wild Racing.
Yeah.
How do you see that one playing out? And also, obviously, I used to always say, never race the Kiwis in March, because they're always on another level. I suspect it'll be much the same, you know, with the guys like Kyle. And yeah. I think it's going to be that home advantage really does pay off in 70.3 World Champs. I mean, you saw it at Sunshine Coast. I think four of the five of the top 10 were Australian or Kiwis.
Yeah.
When it's in Europe, it's pretty much all European.
Yeah.
So the Kiwis have got an edge there. What do you think?
I think course familiarity is huge, not just being a Kiwi racing in New Zealand. You've raced over this bike course. I think course familiarity, and even if it's not conscious course familiarity, even just unconscious, there is a new section to the course for sure, which offers opportunity for some of the really strong swimmers and bikers to get away. But it's that return leg along Broadlands from Reparoa end back to town, which is going to make up 30 or 40 Ks of that race, that is only really well known when you have done it as a race. You can go and recce it, you can ride it a million times and know the terrain, but I think the soul-sucking road surface, the potential for a headwind, the dead roads, all of that's going to come into play. Kyle's done this a billion times.
Mm.
So I think what you'll see is the elite swimmers will work the first 30 Ks to try to see if they can get some separation in that pace line. And because of the likes of Leo Bergier and Hayden Wild in the field, who are going to probably produce those half marathons that we've not really ever seen since South Africa X years ago, running well into the mid-60s,
mm-hmm.
They're going to try to bring a race that creates some separation on the bike leg, different to the T100s that we've seen today. And Kyle knows how to ride off the front of a race. And Rico Bogan's shown that he can do that as well in recent races. So that kind of athlete's going to try to take the race away from Hayden. Hayden said today he's intending on running 105. You and me personally want to see someone do that. We both would love to see a half-distance athlete with that kind of run in them. So I think it's going to be a race to the finish line, but I do think Hayden's going to prevail. If they don't get a gap on Hayden, I think Hayden Wild's the new 70.3 world champion.
Yeah, when Fredino ran a 107 in South Africa, was that super shoot era yet?
No, I don't think so.
So when you think about it,
4%,
105, you know,
it's within reason.
About the equivalent of a 107 probably, or 106. No, 107, I think it's possible. Obviously, South Africa ended up quite a bit of a group ride for those guys. Yeah. And when you looked at what the motorbikes were doing, it was definitely going to be a lot easier a ride than what this one will be. Those dead roads make everyone have to ride.
They're riding, the way the bike is executed at the moment is different to what it was back in Fredino's era. I think I coached Braden at that race, and he got out of the water first and had a terrible transition and ended at the back of that group in 10th place.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to hold it. He just got yo-yoed off the back at all the dead turns.
Yeah.
But at that point in time, we didn't have the power that these guys are bringing to the table. I'm sure Kyle's going to split 350 watts.
Yeah, crazy.
Rico Bogan's going to do the same. Those climbs are not steep. They're power climbs, and they're not going to dent those guys as much. But that's the sort of power that you're dealing with now. And the T100's taught us what they do.
Yeah.
It's swim as hard as you can, bike like it's an Olympic distance race, and whoever dies the least on the run.
Yeah. So I guess what I wanted to chat today about mainly was I got quite inspired by the recent podcast with David Roach and on Rich Roll's podcast.
Yeah.
And interestingly, sort of embarrassed to say this, but I was never a Rich Roll fan. Not because of there was nothing personal. I listened to his podcast a few times. You know when someone's just got their shit together and you're like, oh, you feel a bit bad listening to it. You're like, oh, he's a good looking fella. He said he was gonna quit drinking and he quit forever. I'm like, I've tried that many times. And I was like, damn it. And then weirdly enough, I got invited to go ride with him at in Byron Bay when he was visiting. And I thought, oh, all right, I'll go and meet him. Like, you know, maybe he's all right. And he pulled up and he tried to do a reverse park. And obviously he's used to doing it on the other side of the road. And he just absolutely messed it up. And I thought, right.
Perfect.
I'm going to pour some shit on him and see how he takes it.
As any Kiwi in Australia would do.
And he took it so well. We had a laugh and I was like, damn it. He's actually a really nice guy as well in real life. So, so then I started listening to his podcast again.
It's so simple.
So petty.
Yeah. Fair enough, mate.
And then David Roach, who I found him so fascinating just following him on Twitter to start with, because he was such an open book.
Yeah.
And the great thing, like many pros, including myself, I wouldn't share my heat protocol or my, everything that I was doing, because it's like, I don't want anyone else to get that advantage. And he's just like an open book.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, what we could talk about today is really get your take on the things he discussed. And even if we have slightly different opinions on things or to David, I just want to start by saying, if David ever listens to this, like...
Yeah, help us out.
No, but I found it quite inspiring. I found him inspiring. I registered for a 100K race because of David.
Oh!
So, yeah.
Oh!
I'm back!
So this is notice to the athletes. Out of office is going up. Reedy's back. Mm. Okay. Yeah.
I'm back until I walk back in my house and there's three kids yelling at me. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not back. But yeah, I guess I wanted to work through some of his points, how it relates to triathlon, some of the nuance around things he said.
Yeah.
Obviously, brings up some really interesting studies. I guess the first thing, what would be, you've listened to the podcast?
I've listened to a couple of podcasts he's done post-Leadville.
Okay, yeah. And I guess his approach comes from less mileage, but whenever someone comes with a less mileage approach, there tends to be a bigger, there's still a huge history there.
Yeah. You know?
And any of the athletes you've worked with, what's the number one thing that seems to set them up for success?
Yeah, years and miles on the clock.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think it was 18 years of running before he jumped into the 100-mile race. What would you, like, as an estimate of the athletes you've worked with, how long do you think it takes for athletes to really see their potential?
Depends on whether you're talking age groupers or pros. I think the I should reframe that actually, because most of the pros that end up becoming pros from age groupers, or whether they've already come from an elite single discipline background, genetics is huge. Okay. And if you haven't got the genetics, then you need miles on the clock and you need patience and you need to build over time. But even then, you've got time against you depending on when you enter the sport. But I think a foundation in aerobic exercise, it doesn't always have to be specific to the event. You see so many other athletes coming from other single discipline sports like rowing, for example. They seem to cross over really well. But a background in some form of activity and endurance oriented, but it's certainly, I always think that you've got this wonderful period, 0 to 3 years, where we just shave minutes and minutes and minutes off our times at races. 3 to 5 years, it starts to slow down. And then you have to be very specific. You have to be specific with the stress that you apply to the athletes all through that period, because avoiding injury, consistency in training, frequency of training dose, doesn't have to be too hard. Lots of easy miles incorporated in it. But yeah, 0 to 3 years, we see great improvements for the age grouper. 3 to 5 years, it starts to slow down, and then you need to really know who you're dealing with to continue to see improvements after that. And a lot what David talked about is understanding who he was as an athlete and training for himself, as opposed to training blindly with what other people were suggesting might be better for him.
Yeah, and I really liked how he mentioned, you know, he talks a lot about his cross-training, but also just about how when it comes to building an aerobic base, you know, especially at a cellular level or a fat oxidative level, the body doesn't really care how you do it. Yeah. So, you know, like for you, Braden came from huge paddling background.
Yeah.
And he obviously made a transition to triathlon and was very rapidly very good. Even myself, like I had no background in any of the sports, but I made my way reasonably quickly. And I think it was just the fact I played 3 hours of sport a day as a kid. You know, all that running movement just adds up, you know. So, and I always say it, but no one comes from nowhere. Like even the most talented athletes, they have to have at least that, a pretty substantial base to get there. And I think that really has to, before you go, anyone looks into what David recommends, is always remind themselves that of his background.
Yeah.
You know, that he's built that base.
Well, even the fact that he came from American football.
Yeah.
And had strength training to go in there, because he incorporates strength training now and it's totally different modality to what he did when he was in American football. But he's had a very active lifestyle. And I'll actually remind you of one of your ex-coaches, Alan Cousins.
Yeah.
You read some of Alan Cousins' work and he'll be telling you he wants you to do training in zone zero and zone one for fat oxidation and aerobic development. Now, that's a very, very easy intensity. So it doesn't mean, if you're thinking about triathlon, that could be in your swim and bike run workouts, but there's plenty of athletes out there that have done zone zero and zone one exercise across a period of time that have progressed them as athletes, even though they don't know that they're progressing.
Yeah.
And it's a base of fitness that they can build from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other cool thing is, you know, he brought up that study of the 55-year-old twins who were separated at birth, and one had been a lifelong, well, close to lifelong triathlete, one hadn't.
Yeah.
And how they had just totally remodeled their muscle fibers to be one to be good at in endurance sports. And I think that's important to note too, is how, yes, there's genetics is heavily involved, especially at the top end.
Yeah.
But the amount, the human body is just so bloody adaptable. So especially if you're willing to put the time in. And my biggest frustration with coaching is the athletes that want to get somewhere in 2 years. And you're like, mate, do you know, like, this is a long process. Like, cool your jets. If you if you want to really see your potential, you better lock in for 8 to 10 years minimum.
Yeah, and conversations with athletes like that, and not to deter them and disappoint them and demotivate them straight away, I let them have those goals.
Yep.
But then I let the training process teach them how quickly they start to get fitter, and then they start to work out for themselves, this isn't going to happen in 2 years.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Training evolves relatively slowly.
Yeah, 100%. And I guess leading on from that, he really goes on to into about how important his cross training is to his performances. You know, he's won, set the record at Leadville, 100-mile race, and hadn't raced that distance before, but runs probably the same miles as a lot of pro triathletes less. So not big run mileage, especially for that. Those athletes have known for more like 100-mile run weeks, and he's doing more like 60-mile run weeks.
Yeah.
So 100K a week, which is not massive.
No.
But, you know, the importance of cross-training, and I guess everyone always looked at cross-training, oh, you do that when you can't do the run miles or you're injury-prone, and his quote, or maybe it was his wife's quote, was people are achieving success because of the cross-training, not despite it.
Yeah.
And I know for myself, the further I get away from training for triathlon, like I jumped into a marathon just with clients, and had a way better race, despite not doing a specific marathon prep, quite close to finishing up triathlon, compared to when I did a specific marathon prep with almost no cycling or swimming.
Yeah.
And the ability, especially with cycling, to be able to go out and do 2-3 hour sessions back, you know, over and over and again, is huge, right? And and so, you know, Braden's a classic example too. Very low run mileage and probably one of the fastest runners over Ironman consistently.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do you prescribe, like, do you have athletes that you, not just managing, doing it for managing injury, but you're just like, all right, before the start of the season, we're going to get really fit, and you'll just hold back on the running
Well, you need to be aware of the difference between central and peripheral adaptation. I'm not saying you, I'm saying all of us, and what you're actually trying to achieve. And, you know, cardiovascular fitness, central fitness, metabolic fitness to a certain extent, is can be, you try to choose the lowest intensity modality that you can go for, that you can do a lot of. And running is not that modality. So to build the cardiovascular engine, which does cross over and to other sports as well, certainly reduce the running and focus on swimming and biking, and get that cardiac development. There are many other coaches that would ascribe to the same thing. And then I think the thing for most age group athletes is just because we're born to run, doesn't mean that we're actually structurally capable of running and running lots or running hard. So I am ultra cautious where running's concerned. You know, very rarely across even professionals, unless they're truly proven to be durable enough mechanically to deal with load, I would say 5 hours in a run week would be huge for a lot of my programming. Most people were between 3 and 5. And when you think of how long it takes some age groupers to get through an Ironman marathon, it could equate to their weekly run volume. They are cardiovascularly strong enough to survive an Ironman and run a marathon. You need to train musculoskeletal and peripheral adaptations to the point that they can deal durability-wise with the distance of a marathon, which it doesn't really ever entail running a marathon in training. Nowhere even close. So certainly, you've got to think of the stress that you're getting, how it's affecting you. And we do think between cardiovascular and peripheral, we're getting a shitload of cardiovascular for free with very low injury risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, some of my soon-to-be pros, hopefully, they looked at their plan for like what was going to happen after their little off-season break, and they're like, what, 35K swim weeks? And I'm like,
Yeah, boy. And it's not just to make you a better swimmer.
No, it's just to build base and burn off some, get rid of that Christmas pudding, and then... You know, and then the running's like I really bring that in quite a bit later.
I know. Even in the pro ranks and the age group ranks, running, if you're going to derail your progress as an athlete, it'll be from a running injury. So do whatever you can to avoid getting a running injury.
Consistency is absolute king for the guys that you know, that especially as you get older. Like the through COVID, I was, I'd always been able to take breaks and then come back in 6 weeks and be like really sharp and racing well. And through COVID, obviously Monica went back to work and I just forgot the fact that I'm getting to the other side of the late 30s.
Closer to 40 is what you want to say.
I thought I'd be able to get away with, you know, 8 or 10 hours a week and then come back and meanwhile, Sam Long and all these guys are doing 35-hour weeks. And you're like, geez, came back to racing and got spanked. So talking about, you mentioned being structurally sound enough to be able to handle run load. And I guess David talks about different types of talent. And I've always banged on about this. I really liked his point on this because there's so many other aspects of talent that can make an athlete really good. So I always think of Craig Alexander, for example, he could, or even Lionel, they could handle massive loads. So being able to handle volume is probably one. Can you think of like other types of talent that you'd...
Oh, certainly. Intestinal stability. Certainly musculoskeletal durability is paramount. And some people who come from especially impact loading sports where there's what we call axial bone stress, so jumping and landing, they build up a resiliency that means that their ability to tolerate run load is just far outside. You hear it all the time. Swimmers who come to triathlon, always susceptible for run injuries. Some of it's an innate talent. Some of it's born out of what they've been exposed to in younger days. But going back to the other things like psychological resilience. Ability to suffer. I think is a trainable aspect, and it's also an inherent aspect in a lot of people.
Yeah.
Mainly because I'm sure we're going to get onto this as well when you talk about mindset. I believe mindset drives everything, and the brain's ability to tolerate, which can be, and again, we'll talk about it from gut training and carbohydrate feeding, and then also just the psychological background to that person as well.
Yeah.
We find a lot of elite athletes came from very difficult upbringings.
Mm.
You know, there's been a resilience that's developed over years of life experiences that make them better endurance athletes.
Absolutely.
So there's a whole window of different areas that culminate in those 50 men and 40 odd women that will be on the start list at the 70.3 on the weekend. Physically, yeah, they're gifted, but there's a shitload of other things that go into that that they've learnt over time or they've trained to become better at. And David touches on a number of those things that he identified that he then went off and trained to become better at.
Yeah. I think, and like, even things like someone's ability to be able to sleep well.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've always
been insomniac.
But then other people, it's like, they'll just get 8-10 hours wherever they are, whatever the light's like, doesn't matter the temperature. Other things I can think of is, obviously, David talks about, some people are just so type 1 in their muscle fiber type. I also think some people, that faster twitch is a real advantage, depending on what they're racing. Obviously, their training would probably be quite different.
Yeah.
That they would need for longer course, but you know, you think of guys like Greg Bennett who just inherently had speed and then just did big volume to turn himself into to be able to sustain it for a lot longer. And obviously David talks about, you know, GI tolerability is a bit of a talent, and for me, I'm really curious because I'd love to know more about what his GI, you know, I guess what his GI is like outside of training. Like, does he tolerate most foods?
Yeah.
Sounds like he probably does. And I think it is a talent within itself. So I think athletes listening to his advice need to take into account, well, what's their, you know, what's their health like in their gut?
Yeah.
And, you know, I personally, probably because I'm highly strung and always stressed out, don't tolerate a lot of foods.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, I think the gut is very trainable. I actually have become more convinced of that over the years. I used to feel like it was quite set.
Yeah.
Has your thoughts changed? Or
firstly, the muscle fibre stuff, I really believe strongly that one of the future iterations of sports science will be in categorising athletes on muscle fibre type and then training them based on what we know how muscle fibre type responds. Because I think we're not mature enough in the coaching ranks around the world to be able to identify athletes quick enough to be able to start without making too many mistakes beforehand.
Yep.
And I don't know, I'll ask you, you know, have you ever worked with an athlete that you felt muscle fibre type was the area that you probably needed to take into account the most? Because I personally have. And So if you're born type 1, slow twitch, you're going to really be good at endurance sports. You'll cope with more volume and you'll recover quicker. If you're fast twitch, you need to train differently than the slow twitch person. If you're hybrid, you still need to train differently, but you can morph towards a slow twitcher over time. But I probably have learnt that through mistakes in applying what I'm sure you've done in the past is, well, this is how much we need to do in order to get this good. Why are we falling over all the time? Why are we getting injured? Why are we not responding to the training? And that's important. So yeah, muscle fiber for sure.
Sorry, before you go on to that on further, I just love that you brought that up because I've always thought it'd be so good to know someone's muscle fiber type, what they're, you know, what muscle fiber dominates more, because you would skip that first few months of trial and error to identify, well, are they a high volume aerobic? Do we need high volume and aerobic miles?
Like,
do they tolerate that well, or do we need a lot more intensity, more recovery? And you're 100% right. Like, you can have, I've got athletes at the same level, and it's, I've even got an age grouper who responds high volume.
Yeah.
And Apo's doing probably 10 hours less a week than you.
Yeah.
You know, like, but you just find these patterns of what's working for them.
Yeah.
And it'd be so good to be able to eliminate that trial and error process.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the MRI is getting along that path. We had Phil Ballinger on a few years ago, and they'd just developed the first MRI scan for the athletic population, which I don't think is commercially available yet. But see, the other thing would be looking, and I don't understand the concept enough to speak on it in length, but anaerobic speed reserve, which is a test for a lot of runners that they can do to try to classify who they are as athletes in team sports, so that then they can go off and not give everyone the same type of training to get better. So people in elite sport are trying to make that classification early, but in triathlon, I mean, Jesus, it's the Wild West with coaching as to, and most people are a one size fits all. I think of a Brett Sutton methodology is you fit the program doesn't fit you, and if you don't fit the program, then take your injury and go elsewhere.
Brett's a big fan of the show, Bevan.
Hi, Brett.
So specifically to David's, what I think is might be a talent, or maybe it's just that he's trained really well, 150 grams of carbs an hour.
Yeah.
Running, even in a hot race, because he recently won a hot 100 miler too.
Yeah, yeah.
Pushing that sort of carbohydrate intake. My theory is that it does depend still a lot on someone's electrolyte losses and how much they have to replace.
Yeah.
Like, yes, electrolytes can change a little bit with training and heat adaption. Actually, can change quite significantly, but someone can still be double someone else even after heat adaption in terms of their salt losses. And then they hydration, especially over 6 hour events plus, is so important. But then obviously that competes with how much fuel you can take in.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about getting the right osmolality to be able to take it all in. So I'm really curious whether perhaps another one of his talents is he might not need a lot of electrolytes.
Yeah.
So it doesn't interfere with his fueling, or he might have just an absolute cement gut that he's either trained, or it could be a talent.
Yeah.
Curious on your take on it.
Well, see, knowing you and knowing what you went through in your career, where you felt sodium was a missing link, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll test my memory, and also knowing that you had a sensitive gut, so you had to really find the right amount of electrolyte for you, and it was significant in the end?
Yeah, it was significantly high, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then never really been able to get past, say, 30 or 40 grams per hour in terms of gut. I would suspect that there are people on that, and that's an extreme, and I would question as to whether how trainable their gut is, because then I think there's the brain-gut axis that comes into play that's playing a lot with that, and like you mentioned, highly strung, probably errs towards a little bit too much cortisol floating around in the system all the time, ready to a T. I think there's going to be a challenge there.
Yeah.
But are we? Do we like approach this as we did with sports nutrition only a few years ago, where we said, well, the upper limit is X.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, do we find an athlete that's not tolerating and then we just give up on them? Or do we do what we seem to be doing now, which is saying, no, expose them to more situations where gastrointestinal distress occurs and they will adapt over time? I think you'll find it as equally interesting as what I did about the question around unoxidized carbohydrate that sits in the gut. I didn't know that it actually became brain fuel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's proven.
No.
But that's what David suggested.
Based off the research.
Based off the research, and I certainly hadn't heard that either.
Yeah,
which was really interesting.
Because I think a few years ago, both you and I, who went through a large low carbohydrate phase, were really against overfueling on race day for whatever reasons at that particular point in time. And you'll still get those people who sit in that field that think 150 or 120 grams per hour is too much. I mean, say for example, Dan Plews, I'm pretty sure, would say that that's becoming a little bit risky. But the thing is, like anything where sports nutritionists are concerned, is that they're using this train it methodology now. Create those situations where you're very close to some sort of gastric distress. Cell lining might change. It might become more malleable. It might exit the gut a little bit quicker.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point that he's making. The fact that he could get at his size, he'd be only the same size as you, maybe a bit taller.
Probably, likely.
Sorry, mate. But 150 is phenomenal.
Yeah.
as a runner, where we know that there's more movement in the gut when you're trying to digest it, which just makes you more susceptible.
Yeah.
But he doesn't sound like he did many sessions where he wasn't trying to, specific sessions where he wasn't trying to stress the gut in some way.
Yeah, so I think even if people say, oh, that's too high, I think it's the principle of, hey, let's just push it another 5 grams, 10 grams, gradually see what your upper ceiling can be.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, more glucose should improve performance in most cases if you don't get GI distress.
Yeah.
And we have to remember it is N equals one.
Yeah.
But we are seeing it with other athletes too. So it's not, you know, it's not completely one person. And like you said, I found I tried over and over again.
Yeah.
And I did all these 3 hour rides at Ironman pace into 30K runs week after week until I could work out. And the lower I went, the better I was feeling and going.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying anyone should do that low because I think that was a bit ridiculous. And I still, if it had gone another half hour of the run, I probably would have passed out. So I was absolutely on fumes towards the end.
I'll survive another 12Ks and another hour and a half on the bike.
So everyone has to, I think, trial and error on themselves and make sure that you've got to find what works for you, but don't feel like it's set. I think that was the biggest lesson I took away from that.
And do you know, see, the thing is, we've come through this low carbohydrate era, and I was one of the biggest proponents of that. And our podcast just focused on that for years. And I don't feel disingenuous in saying that I've come full circle again. There are definitely periods of the year where a low carbohydrate approach is good for health. But from a sports performance perspective, we're back to this conversation around high carbohydrate. Not everyone's going to get to that end, but one of the things that I thought was really interesting, because durability is the big thing that we're focused on. What are the factors that improve a durability in athlete, you know, psychological, training wise, nutrition wise? But one of the things that I took from that podcast, which I really thought was interesting, was the point that he said that the unoxidized carbohydrate will be used by the brain. And if the brain feels happy because it's getting glucose, it will perform, it won't change the rate of exertion.
Mm-hmm.
So the perceived rate of exertion remains comfortable for him. He feels he can keep going for longer. And then that reminded me of the carbohydrate mouth rinse, where the theory was take some carbohydrate into the mouth, but don't swallow it, spit it out again, and you'll extend the ability of time to exhaustion. So the brain is receiving some signals about, hey, there's heaps of fuel available. Don't downregulate performance. Don't slow the muscles down. Don't change how hard I'm perceiving this exercise to be.
Yep.
And as he mentions in the Rich Roll interview, he didn't even feel tired.
Yeah.
At the end of his bloody 100 miler, which I'm like, this durability thing is where I'm really focused on and what affects that. And we see so much slowing down in age group Ironman where athletes are only taking in 30 to 60 grams because they're small athletes. Well, he's not a big athlete either.
Mm.
150 grams is massive, huge.
And that's what I actually got told this probably 10 years ago and have thought about it a lot. And he backed it up a little bit too in that the body size doesn't really matter that much.
I know.
In terms of how much someone can take in. So the classic formula was, you take in 2 grams of carbs per kilo or whatever.
Yeah.
But I've never really found a pattern between, obviously, bigger athletes, a little bit more.
Yeah.
But it's not like I've seen smaller athletes have to take half the amount.
No.
So the
standardized guidelines it was. Yeah. It was to take if we're not going to consult with a nutritionist, let's just put something out there that gives us a ballpark figure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that glucose going to the brain once again just shows how the brain is the central governor and can, you know, and who knows, like he even touched on it, maybe his bike crash where he had that head injury.
Yeah.
He thinks it might have affected his perception of pain possibly or something. Yeah. I might be messing that up.
Think it felt that there was a remodeling that occurred. He couldn't quite pinpoint what it was, whether it was perception of effort or not. But he felt that his brain is a different brain than the one that was. I'm not saying people have a bike accident. Yeah. This will cure you. there was one point I wanted to raise about that we'll get to it. I was going to ask your opinion on it, but we'll get to it if I remember.
Right. So I love that he talks about exogenous ketones. It's been something I'm really interested in because partly because I'm sort of pissed off that it that it's allowed, because I don't like things that aren't accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
And to do it properly with the right esters that you need to do, it's somewhere around $50 to $60 a day.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, stop allowing things that like...
Yeah, beyond the...
Let's stop making sport more and more inaccessible to the masses, you know?
Yeah.
Same way that even though I love super shoes and I love nice bikes,
yeah,
I'm like, I'd love it if there was a bit of more restriction purely from a, I guess, from an accessibility perspective for people from all levels of socioeconomic status, you know? So that just come, let me start with that. In saying that, if I was racing and it was allowed, I would 100% be taking it. For me, it's black and white. Do the rules allow it? Do they not? If they banned it, I'd stop straight away.
Yeah.
Reason being is, while it's still only, I think there's only one study that shows that 20% increase in natural EPO production, which for those listening, that means you create more red blood cells. And so athletes are now taking it after sessions to aid recovery and to boost their red blood cells. Interestingly, David mentioned the potential side effects, which I hadn't actually heard before, that there was a possibility of a decrease in testosterone. You don't have to talk about this, you don't know. Do your athletes use exogenous ketones?
Well before the studies came out about the recovery potential for them, more as a secondary fuel source during an event, which has now been relatively disproven as such. And the big study that they looked at, rates of recovery for post-workout exogenous ketone consumption did show some significant benefits for the rate of recovery. And it's not just EPO, it could be mitochondrial function, glycogen replenishment. It's multifaceted as to where the improvements come. I'm really intrigued by it as well. I would suspect that for one of my pro athletes, the next significant Ironman build, we might be implementing something like that. Like you say, the cost is prohibitive. You could go down the ester salts, which are slightly cheaper. They're not quite, you don't get as much bang from your buck in terms of fuel per gram. They don't quite digest as easily. If you were really
I think even in the study, that it was quite cheeky, but they used a brand that was esters, and now they actually sell salts. So it's not proven that that particular brand, even though they're in the study, will create the same effect, whereas there is one brand that is definitely the ester that can give that effect. Interestingly, I was wondering after this, I did a little bit of reading up on, I found one study that showed exogenous ketones actually can, for dopamine levels during activity, was almost a twofold increase in dopamine. And so I was curious, why do people keep telling me they feel better when they take it racing if there's no glycogen sparing effect?
And
then why did David finish the 50-mile race and was feeling terrible and his wife gave him some exogenous ketones? Because she knew he'd feel better about doing the 100-mile. And I was like, he probably got a dopamine hit.
And you and I have both been in a ketogenic state at some point in our lives as athletes. And the clarity, cognitive clarity, is actually quite alluring.
There's no
debate around how clear you're thinking when you're in ketosis.
Even before this podcast, my meals today was like, when I do a podcast with someone who I know is going to be quite well-spoken, it's not the usual losers. Sorry, guys. No, I'm the worst out of all of them. I want to have a clear mind. So I had... I had a piece of chicken for lunch and just basically zero carbs because I don't like the fade.
That's that a jib. Yeah. It's got a hangover, really.
Yeah. Vomited it all up.
But you, I agree. I picked up on that point as well, and he didn't really clarify as to why... what he would feel, because she said she was giving him some ketones post-event for recovery purposes, but when you hear what he said in the interview, it was to get him to agree to sign up to the next race when he knew, when he physically was going to be feeling bad, but cognitively he was sharp as.
So I
have to agree.
I guess he talked about heat as sort of being a revolutionary thing. I sort of disagree with that aspect of it. I mean, you and I have been using heat with our athletes for 10 years. There's nothing really new there, so I'll skip over that bit.
Well, what I would say, however, that of all the modalities that he spoke about, if you're an age group athlete out there, consider heat.
Oh, yeah.
And don't even... So we do a lot of heat stress work for any of our athletes, whether they're racing in a hot environment or not, for the plasma increase that everyone's after from a heat perspective. Even if you're racing in a moderate climate or temperate climates, having the extra plasma is going to be of benefit. But I think the take home that he mentioned, which I thought was really interesting, is if you have access to heat, do it all the time, year round. And you're training as a result of that, you'll train at a higher capacity because you've always got that extra plasma. So I reckon I would say of all the things we talk about today, heat is the lowest hanging fruit for the age group athlete out there.
I would agree. There is an exception to that in my mind, is that as triathletes, we are incurring heat a lot. If you're doing a lot of volume across
three
sports...
Hold on a second. Which country do you live in?
No. I'm not talking about... You're in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Heat. But sometimes for athletes, especially when they're quite a way away from their event,
yeah,
and it's a really stressful week, and I know they're going to be getting a decent sweat up anyway, maybe not quite the stimulus I'd go for when I'm doing specific heat adaption.
Yeah.
I don't add in heat stress because I'm worried about tipping the overall stress
too
much.
Which you can do in a heartbeat with heat.
Yeah, absolutely. You see it in Kona all the time. Athletes that have been there 3 weeks,
they've
either got it right and got out of the heat and recovered, or they're staying in a place that they don't sleep well because it's hot. And, you know, heat is... It's a great stimulus, but it is another stress.
Yeah, and only 15 minutes taking your core temperature to the right level will wipe you for hours afterwards, even into the next day.
Yeah.
So you've got to be really cautious with where you start and how you gradually increase it.
Yeah, exactly. I make my athletes do it in the morning because I see the HRV and resting heart rates sort of wrecked if they do it too late. Interestingly, David does it at night, you know, I think once you're really adapted, you can get away with it. So I think, year round, if you live in a cold environment, for sure, potentially don't do it in your biggest training weeks if there's already so much on your plate that you know, and you're trying to hit some really key sessions. And anything else on heat I was thinking about?
You're going to skip past it, but I
managed to
stop.
Skip past it? No,
and you did have something to add.
Yeah, there you go. What else we got from him? So the interesting thing for me, obviously you probably include strides in a lot of your athletes running. Any caveats to what David talked about with strides?
Well,
you should mention what the benefit was, if you don't mind, about the... It was a 4% improvement in economy across for all athletes, including two sets of strides.
Yeah, and his is just 30 seconds, aren't they?
Yeah.
Do you know, again, let's circle back to where he started with his decision on the lower mileage running was coming at from a speed perspective. Like, who the hell comes at an ultra marathon from top down rather than bottom up?
Yeah.
And I found that interesting as well. So not only the value of 4 to 6 30-second strides, which I've seen heaps of evidence before as being the only quality that a lot of athletes include in their running. That's all they need is the mechanical. And that is really classically be referred to as a sprint interval training session or something similar, which does have some positive correlations to VO2.
Yep.
But Dave skinned this cat with a top-down approach of worrying about how quick he was over 5Ks. Which is, if you think about it, we're talking about power or velocity at VO2. Is what he was looking at. So how fast can you go at maximal and how much power can you push at maximal oxygen consumption? And if that can be high enough, then all sub-thresholds below that will come into line. And the pace that he wanted to run Leadville at, the only way he could get to that was to have his velocity at VO2 sufficient enough so that his top of zone 2 running was 5 minutes 30 per mile. So whether he achieved that through some of his biomechanical neuromuscular work and strides, but he was out there doing high quality run sessions for an ultra, which I don't know anyone.
But I would also suggest when you still look at his total volume, he's still not really moving away from the... A lot of his volume is still easy aerobic. Oh, it's just on the bike, so I think athletes have to be careful of, so I've only got 5 runs a week, I'm going to do 4 of them with intervals.
Yeah.
His total, he's still probably in that 10 to 20% range of intensity, and he's polarized. So fast that top of zone 2 is quite fast. Like those a lot of his run sessions would look quick, but he's still not at a really stressful, sitting in that zone three. I mean, he does do faster for sure, but it's still the balance in the equation of the slower or easier to quite hard intensity is still pretty typical.
Yeah. Well, the lesson from that for me was, for most age group athletes, I would, in their running program, only have strides.
Yeah.
You know, the value that he got out of 6 30-second efforts twice a week and everything else done at a very low intensity. And then he even talked about how low and slow he goes.
Yeah.
So, which was really heartwarming because even though 5:30 per mile pace is the top of his zone too, he was talking about tooling around at 7-minute mile pace as well. So he runs, most age group athletes, when you give them their zones, they want to run at the top of that zone. So, you know, this is an easy run. Zone one, zone two is generally my description. Well, they're at the top of that zone two. When they could easily be down at the top of zone one.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That used to be my biggest frustration as an athlete, was when a coach would give me a zone two run.
Yeah.
And say, well, you'd want me to do 3:55 pace.
Yeah.
Or do you want me to do 4:40 pace?
Yeah.
Like, that's my zone two at the moment, you know? So,
yeah.
And that was... very different stress on the body.
Yeah. So, and that's when age group athletes need to look at, they hear the paces that elite athletes are able to run, and then they realize how far off they are from that. But they don't realize that that is your zone too.
Yeah.
And that's why you're an elite athlete.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where they get confused and think, to run fast, I have to run fast.
How often do you hear that after a race? I'm just missing some top end speed. I'm like, no. You're missing 10 years of miles.
I need more intervals. Yeah.
I guess to wrap up, before we move on from that, I think I was interested in his comment about the super shoes and how they lower the risk of injuries. And I think there's some nuance around that. And he did mention he runs, like he could run his Adios Pro 3 right to the death. And I would 100% agree with that shoe.
Yeah.
It doesn't... I can do the same with it.
Yeah.
Now, Nike's on the other hand, 100K, and I can feel my biomechanics are messed up.
Yeah.
So you have to be really... I think be careful with that advice. Some super shoes, Saucony's one, that Endorphin Pro or Elite, whatever it's called, I've always found you could. But there are other shoes that you can see even when someone's standing. Their mobility through the ankles is scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I that would be one thing. That's an N equals one for him. Because he talked about how he could actually incorporate it into all his training, and he didn't just use it. He doesn't, but he could. And then I saw a video of him running, and biomechanically, he really looks good at top speeds. And I would suspect that... I'd have to go back to the video, but he did not look like a heel striker. He might have been midfoot, not forefoot, but certainly midfoot. You get most people come off the couch and they go, I bought these at new expensive shoes. I'm going to run in them a lot. And we all only have to stand on the 70.3 course on the weekend and see the velocities that some of these people are running at. Their mechanics are all over the place.
Yeah.
Because these shoes do need to be run relatively faster.
Yeah.
Tooling around at 7 minutes. Per k's or something like that in these shoes, and you're going to not be running that often and that frequently.
It's fine. Yeah, so my recommendation to my athletes, so I get them, you know, the old shoes that we used to race in that were very simple, but I'll get them running 6-minute k runs in those.
Yeah.
And then when they're going fast, we bring in the super shoes for that reason. I feel like the biomechanics look good when it's quick and they look really bad when it's slow. And you hear that even in Ironman. Oh, the Alpha Flies felt great until I got fatigued and then I felt like they were working against me.
Yeah, yeah. And we did a podcast not long back about some really good research into that, and you need to slowly integrate them.
Yep.
So if you are intending on running in them more often, only do 15 minutes and then go back to your old shoes. There is a recruitment, strain, proprioception change that you're not ready for extended periods of time that you've got to just slowly build up to, or you will injure yourself running in your fast shoes. And
the injuries are, I guess, you still get the common injuries, but there is a difference, I think, in general of the injuries that you see. You're starting to see less calf Achilles stuff compared to what we used to get. A lot higher up stuff, knees, hips, lower back especially, because it is so much bounding and people don't have the core or the technique to really stop the spine from jarring every time the trampoline shoes take off.
Yeah. So, but we will go out there on the weekend and 95% of both fields are in super shoes.
I'll be spectating in super shoes just so I can...
So you look the part.
Yeah. And he's right. They are fun. They make running more fun.
Yeah.
Again, it comes back to, I wish in some ways, like kids weren't allowed to use them so that you don't have kids who can get 400 shoes versus kids who can't have $100 shoes. But that's a whole other topic.
You are about equality, aren't you, mate?
It's funny because I'm quite capitalist in some ways when it comes to RPG.
Oh, you've always been good with the dollar. You've always been good with your sponsorship negotiations.
Actually, speaking about that, I started I'm organising the sponsorship for Nerd Belt.
Yeah.
I always thought, geez, I got lucky with sponsors. Reaching out to these
Yes,
athletes.
You did.
Yeah,
you...
no, but listen. I know I was overpaid for sure. But I reach out to these athletes and, like, you know, either don't get a response or you get a response and then, yeah, I'm interested. You put forward an offer, you don't hear back. And you're like, God, what are you doing? Like,
I know.
You're in off season.
You're in a different era, mate.
I'm like, start the negotiations. Someone's offering to pay you. And I'm like, man,
you're in a different era. When if you got a cold emailed by a brand back in the day, you were having a conversation.
I was like, where should I start? I'll take it for 200K. And they're like, we'll give you five. I'm like, deal.
Not a great negotiator, but I'd certainly have the conversation.
Probably only going to offer 500 if I didn't.
I don't want to even bring it up, but Saucony, they were great, weren't they? You'll be buried in a coffin with a pair of Sauconys, won't you?
I was definitely overpaid. But I put the work into it. Like, I'm really surprised with some pros. I'm off topic about that.
No, it is a good point. I think it's, I don't know if it's a generational thing and the kids that are coming through now have a completely different life experiences and are there with a handout.
Yeah.
Like, what do we need to do? A couple of social media posts or whatever. I think that there is huge opportunity. There's a lot of money coming into the sport. You've got to start somewhere and work with a brand. And I see a lot of people struggling with that concept. And I don't know if it's just a generational thing or not.
And the, I hate to say this, but the worst, from what I've seen, are the ones coming out of high performance programs.
Oh, 100%.
Because they have never had to do anything for themselves. No, and I'm like, you guys need to... And they're probably the most talented, probably going to win the most races, and they're killing their careers because they're not looking after their sponsors.
I can see a number of people after each Olympics knowing how to play the game and how not to, and then they wonder why they're struggling to make ends meet.
Mm. Okay, I guess wrapping up, mindset. We talked a little bit about potentially Dave's head injury might have helped, but I think that's something that, like you said, is trainable. I think that what really makes an athlete successful comes back to mindset, not just while they're racing, because some people can do all the right things on race day, but it's about being able to get up and grind day in, day out. I think being able to race focusing on the right things, going out there and trying to win a world title for the pros on the weekend, instead of being like, okay, what do I need to do right now, right here in the swim? Yeah. Where do I need to be? Not overanalyzing things and being able to bring it all back to the moment is such a crucial skill when racing.
Yeah.
And I struggled with it. And I reckon I only got it right for, you know, a year or two. I worked with a sports psych and I learned to just be really in the moment.
Yeah.
And it sounds like David makes it out like he set this really ambitious goal, time-based goal. I'm going to run 16 minutes quicker. And he put it out there as beginner's luck. I don't really see it like that. He would have known his numbers so well, he would have been like, this is going to sound outrageous, but this is my physiology. I've looked at the course. This is what I think I can do.
Yeah.
And I'm going to beat everyone else. This is the time I'm going to go for, because it's quite, for him, it was an objective thing that he felt like he could achieve rather than I'm going to win this race, because you can't control who else turns up.
Yeah. I think for me, my take on that was, it wasn't something he plucked from the air. It became audacious when he realized, when he'd done all the math on it, that his numbers said he was going to run 16 minutes sharp. Now, his choice then is to make that public or not make that public. So whilst it was an audacious goal, it became audacious once he decided to make it public. Because you know yourself, if you keep these things to yourself, you can go about your business, and if you fail, no one cares. So I do think, and mindset is I believe in the last couple of years of my coaching, I've been more a psychologist than a physiologist, and I'm neither either of those. But it comes back to some research in and around the allostatic processes of the brain, which deliver the resources to the body to perform the function that it's about to do. And it comes in the term of threat perception. So we are about to do a race, which is a threat. How much do we believe that we're going to be successful at this race is going to determine how successful we are at this race. If we think we're not going to be successful in this race, the chances of success just disappear. Now, that's a belief thing.
Yep.
You know, that's a mindset thing. Your resources, your body will function, your blood will flow, your metabolism will work in a state of positivity much better than it will in a state of negativity. And we decide which state we exist in. So if you just come back to athletic performance, giving yourself the best chance, and whether it's sports psych or whether it's hypnotherapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, something that allows you to on race day, to dream of the perfect day out that then you can invest yourself into. And then I always say on race day for athletes that they are the eye of a storm. The storm is the other athletes moving all around them, and all they're concentrated on is themselves.
Yep.
And the other athletes will come and go, nothing to do with your race.
Yeah.
Unless you get some legal drafting.
Yeah.
Other than that,
yep.
Focus on the process, focus on what you know you can deliver. And then if you step back from that, do it in training a number of times.
And I guess that to add to that is that's why I think training, you can develop those skills. Yeah. So I'll encourage athletes during a hard session, what are you going to think about during the race to stay in the moment?
Yeah.
You know, like might be focusing on relaxing the shoulders, and that's all you're telling yourself, or breathing through diaphragmatic breathing or whatever it is. And exactly what you said is you've got to be able to do that in the race. And I think practicing it in training and really working on it is going to be key to be able to do it when you're under stress and under the real race situation.
Yeah, you cannot, like the biggest problem in 70.3 and mainly in Ironman is believing that where you are in that moment in time is not going to get you to your, and let's say for age groups, to your goal time.
Yep.
Not realizing that within the next 10 hours of the race, if you're slightly behind your world record line at that point in time, doesn't mean you're going to be there across the entire day.
Yeah.
And that's what blows most athletes' minds. They've set their swim split up. They know what they want to bike. They know what they want to run. But the moment emotionally they feel they're behind that point in time, the wheels fall off.
Yeah.
So you've got to forget about what you want to swim, what you want to bike, and what you want to run. Work to your heart rate numbers, your power numbers, your pace numbers, whatever they are, and just focus on those, you know? And that's the only thing that matters at that particular moment. The future doesn't matter. The past doesn't matter.
Yep.
That moment is the only thing that matters. And it's a skill, and people say they're doing it in training, but you almost really want to reinforce it and say, what else did you think about in this last 5 minutes?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, such and such is up the road.
Yep.
And my age group was, and it's like that, immaterial, doesn't matter. Yeah.
Bev, you've been, as I expected, probably one of our better guests. So, no, I really appreciate you taking the time. Some great advice, especially, you know, off the back of what Dave said, how it can apply to triathlon and some nuance there. So, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for taking me into your house using your recording device.
Do you want Chris to edit it?
Yeah. That's what I was hoping.
When you want to post it? When you want to post it and produce by?
Tonight. No. but I really appreciate it. And, you know, I've got anything you want to promote?
No. Other than keep doing what you're doing, Reedy. Your business looking in from the outside. I've probably been coaching longer than you, but you've had an incredible athletic career, and I've enjoyed getting to know you over the last couple of years as well, and what RPG is doing. I do enjoy your podcast. I've used segments of your podcast before, so it's not all madness that you guys talk about, but it's always good to catch up, and we'll see you out there on the race course.
Awesome. Thanks, Bev.